is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Achilles, the wrath of Achilles. When Achilles, learning his good friend and older stepbrother Patroclus is dead, Achilles rouses himself from the Greek camp, puts on his shining armor, and swears he will revenge Patroclus' death and the mistreatment of Patroclus' body. He swears he will make the Trojans pay. He fills the Scamander River with corpses. That is not enough. He demands Hector fight him, Hector the son of Priam, the number one warrior in Troy. Achilles says, I will kill you. I will kill you, and I will not back off even slightly. Achilles does kill Hector, and then, because it's not enough for Achilles, he mistreats Hector's corpse. He drags him around the city. Hector's corpse is protected by the gods, but in any event, Achilles goes beyond your expectation of a threat. What is important here is the threat is acted upon. And I welcome Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution, a classicist who knows this story very well, writing most recently about the threats being issued by opponents in the Mideast War. There are two wars underway right now in Eurasia. A third war is threatened. But one war is dominated by threats not acted upon. Victor, a very good evening to you. Achilles made threats. Hector made threats. And then they were honor-bound to act on them. That is not apparently the way modern diplomacy is working. Is the modern version more effective than the heroic age? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. No, that's not. I think Teddy Roosevelt captured best the Hellenic spirit when he said, speak softly, carry a big stick. I think the current administration is talking loudly with a twig. In other words, every time we've had 83 or more now incidents of Iranian aggression at American assets, I think we've responded four or five times. And yet we keep issuing these statements. We're going to hit back. And now they've even added a little qualifier, John. They said, at a time of our choosing, which means we're not going to get into a trap of attacking you back or responding. So we're slowly, systematically, insidiously losing deterrence. And I think Iran knows that. So they're going to up their aggression.
And the effectiveness of this threat, it certainly does get the attention in the headlines. Is that the ambition, to get attention and not actually to defeat the enemy? It can seem at some point as if there's a dance going on and both sides know the rules and they don't cross those rules.
Well, the United States knows that after the Kabul fiasco and the amount of aid we're sending to Ukraine and the new alliance of Russia, China, Iran, maybe even Qatar and Turkey, it doesn't have the wherewithal, and especially given the threat to Taiwan, to get bogged down in a Middle East war. We don't have a good record in the Middle East. That said, Iran also understands that Russia's not going, its newfound allies, Russia and China, are not going to come to their aid. And they understand if Hezbollah does what Hamas does and attacks Israel, it'll be costly for Israel, but it'll end up like Gaza City or maybe Beirut in 2006. So, and we've got more power in the Mediterranean than we've ever had with these two carrier groups. So Iran knows that if it were to attack the United States assets, it could not stop a retaliation. We could take out its nuclear program. We could take out its power, its water, its communications, its military bases within 2 weeks. And they understand that. So this little cat and mouse game is, it's telling Hezbollah, the Houthis, hit a little bit, prick here, aggravate there, attack Americans here, but don't do anything that would incur a massive Israeli or American response. And the Americans know that, so they don't want to respond because they feel there's a slight chance of a theater-wide war that they don't want to deal with, given Ukraine and what happened to them in Afghanistan and Taiwan.
In your most recent piece on American greatness, you remind us of a moment now gone behind us, early in the conflict between the IDF seeking to defeat the killers of 10/7/23, that Secretary Blinken for the United States lowered the flags of the United States to half-mast in some fashion to commemorate civilian casualties. Just about the same time, the hospital was said to be destroyed, 500 dead, I think was the first report, by an Israeli missile. All false. All false. And afterwards, the reaction of Hamas was entertained by the major media. What are they going to do? They're grieving. The Israelis did this. All false. And you entertain what was the most likely reaction from Hamas to Mr. Blinken's lowering the flags, half flags. What do we learn from these exchanges? What could Mr. Blinken have learned from the way Hamas reacted?
Well, he could understand that the mentality in the Middle East in general, but especially among Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran, is that any sign of outreach, of magnanimity, is going to be reciprocated with the idea that it's weakness to be exploited and not to be treated in kind. And we know that. So this administration came in when Iran was prostrate. It was financially insolvent. It was cornered. It was trapped by the Trump administration. Soleimani was dead. Al-Qaeda was wiped out in Iraq. And what did it do? It said, well, this is the time to be magnanimous to Iran. We lifted the sanctions. We started negotiating with hostages. We said the Houthis were no longer terrorists. And we dropped that. We started restoring aid to not just the Palestinians, but also Hamas. And the result is what we have now. And that is all of these interests looked at the United States and said, wow, they're in a superior position, and yet they want to give it up and allow us to recover. So they must be without confidence or decadent, or I don't know what they were.
The Iranians have similar opinions of the United States after all these provocations. They fired, as I understand it, their Houthi surrogates fired drones and missiles at Eilat, the resort town in the Red Sea, of something more than one ton of explosives, intercepted by the U.S. Navy. But in any event, it was meant to be a mass killing. And that is in response to the U.S.'s magnanimity of following the civilian casualties. What we're dealing with is an enemy who is very well informed that the U.S. doesn't mean it, Victor. That would be one conclusion. But we do mean it. That's what's odd. We do mean it, and yet the message is not delivered.
Yeah, it's very dangerous because war breaks out when all of the interested parties do not know the relative strength of each one. And then if they're not manifest and people are not told what the relative powers are, people do something stupid. So we're giving the impression that we are weak when we're actually very strong, as you point out. So Iran and Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis do something stupid, as they did with Israel. They feel, well, maybe psychologically or spiritually they're spent, and even though they have all this wherewithal, they won't use it. So and that's even worse, because if we had that wherewithal, we would use it. But they're so decadent, they won't. And then they get into an aggressive mode, and Israel demolishes Gaza City and Hamas. And Hamas should have known that, but the Israelis were trying to be magnanimous. They had guest workers. They were working on the Abraham Accord. They were actually helping Gazans, and that message was not clear to Gaza that if you do something stupid, you're going to pay a terrible price. And that's what I'm worried about, is that Iran's not getting the message, and neither is Hezbollah, that we have the power to annihilate you, but we do not want to do that, so don't provoke us. And yet they're provoking us.
The end of the Second War. Endings of wars are very difficult. Clemenceau said much harder to make peace than it is to make war. The end of the Second War, I'm reading a new book, Judgment at Tokyo, by a professor who spent time with the Tokyo war crimes, but it begins with the ending of the war. And Harry Truman, who suddenly was in office, was presented with the option of the atomic weapons, which he was told were more terrible than any weapon we have that can destroy a city, and then the firebombing by Curtis LeMay's B-29, city after city. We pounded them. And there's reason to argue, Victor, that without that pounding, the Japanese would not have surrendered, would have pulled their army into the Home Islands, and dug in and obliged the population of 70 million to die in place, to make some savage apocalyptic sacrifice to their understanding of strength. That was not the choice that Truman and Marshall and the Joint Chiefs made. They said, we're going to pound them and intimidate them into surrender. Will that work with Iran, pounding them? Because right now, we're not. It's not working.
If you understand that you don't have to be perfect to be good, when your references were that there were 7 million civilians that were armed and over a million crack troops on the Japanese mainland, 7,000 aircraft. They could have easily, had we invaded, killed, as was feared, 1 million Americans. But we had no compunction. We dropped leaflets during the fire raids. We told them, as the Israelis are telling the Gazans, to leave the cities, and then we bombed them. And they had dispersed aircraft production all over civilian centers, very similar to what Gaza is doing. And that generation said, we don't want to do this, but we would prefer to do this to the alternative of losing an American million-person army. And so you have to have that confidence, but we have a kind of a utopianism that we have to be absolutely perfect to be good. And the evil knows that. And so they manipulate it, and they do that with the Israelis. And so all of these charges, John, very quickly, genocide, apartheid, colonialism, they're kind of specious arguments, because nobody in the UN or the Middle East is saying, my God, there's 200,000 refugees in Cyprus because of the Turkish invasion. Wow, there's 13 million Germans that left Prussia. They're refugees. They've been there for 70 years. They've lost their homes and ancestry. So it's so asymmetrical, and nobody's worrying about the Darfur, where mostly Muslim Sudanese killed over 500,000 people. Nobody's talking about that genocide. Nobody's saying that from the river to the sea is an endorsement of genocide. So the thing is so asymmetrical, and I don't know whether it's Israel becomes Western or it's Jewish or what the special considerations are among the global left, but they apply a standard to Israel in particular and the United States in general that's lunatic, that they don't apply to any other illiberal regime, and we're liberal. I mean, the Turkish president is lecturing Israel about disproportionate bombing when they tried to wipe out the Kurds, and they took half of Cyprus and gave it to people that didn't belong to it, and they expelled, as I said, almost 250,000 Greeks. No one said a word.
Is it too late to convince Tehran? Is this administration in a box it can't get out of?
Well, I think, I don't know that for a fact, but I would imagine that Tehran is furiously contacting the United States and saying, we're going to bluster and we've let some people attack you, and you're perfectly willing to respond to those attacks, but we do not want a war with you, and we're not going to intervene, so please don't bomb us. We have to maintain control, and we're going to give all this rhetoric, but please don't bomb us. And the other administration would see that as a sign of weakness and say, listen, we're not going to let you do these demonstrative attacks on our forces in, you know, Syria or Iraq. We're not going to tolerate one dead American, and you took hostages via Hamas, and we're going to retaliate. And that would send a message, and we probably could. They know that, John. They know that they're in the most vulnerable position they've been since they took over from the Shah. There is no restraint on any retaliation to Iran now. Not China, not Russia, not world opinion, not the Europeans, not the people in the Middle East. Everybody wants Iran to get its comeuppance, and they know that. And they're very vulnerable. They don't have the defensive capability to stop it, either from us or Israel. But they have to have street cred. So they have to be vocal, as you point out. They have to be boisterous, but they don't want to follow that up.
Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution, a classicist writing in American Greatness, In Search of Achilles. We're going to turn to the other war in Eurasia. I'm John Batchelor.